morning. Next case on the court's calendar is State of Minnesota versus Gary Bogatz. We are ready for argument. We'll hear from counsel for Mr. Bogatz first. Would you please introduce yourself for the record? We know who you are, but that way the recording will know who you are.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you need to, you're free to raise the podium. Yeah.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Gary Bogatz. Our contention in this appeal is that Mr. Bogatz's conviction must be reversed due to the erroneous admission of his statement to the police on April 3rd of 2020, which was taken in violation of his asserted right to counsel under Miranda. And secondarily, that the weight of the remaining evidence considered under the standard of review from either Ray, that I rely on, or Townsend, relied on by respondent, is insufficient to affirm this conviction without the erroneously admitted evidence. I can begin by discussing or reviewing the issue on my client's asserted right to counsel, which I think appropriately begins with the statement itself. Immediately after his Miranda advisory, my client stated, "I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer."
What about the comments afterward where the officer repeatedly asks if he understands his rights and do you want to keep talking to us?
Well, the statement that I really think I should have a lawyer, one, would be a clear indication he very well understood his rights. So I failed to see the purpose of that follow-up question other than, as I think I argue in my brief, an attempt to get away from that subject. And I know that the district court ruled or found that this statement was somehow equivocal, even though it is essentially identical to the statement made in State v. Hannon that I rely on. But even arguably, if there were equivocation there, the follow-up questions that needed to be asked, as both Edwards and this state and Robinson held, need to expressly direct address the issue of counsel. And I think the record is clear, and I have it printed out in front of me, that Investigator Kritschek studiously avoided that topic.
You think that he has to say lawyer or counsel in his questioning about?
That's what Edwards and Robinson say. I've cited it in my brief. I believe Robinson is just quoting Edwards, that the follow-up question must address the issue of counsel. And to simply ask, do you understand your rights, is general and, I would argue, evasive. The fact is that, again, I mean, the district court's order doesn't contain any citation to case law relating to clear requests for counsel, nor any dealing with equivocation. It simply found that the statement was equivocal, and that directly conflicts with Hannon and, I think, Munson.
Does the number of times he asks about his rights enter into the formulation here, or is it just black and white?
I'm not following you.
Well, the officer asked several times if he wanted to continue to talk to him. I mean, it wasn't just one time. He said three or four times, you want to talk to us.
Well, what I have here, his first response was, so I read your rights, do you understand them? And Mr. Bogatz said, yeah. The next question is, do you wish to talk to us now? Which is a departure from the legal strictures placed on the investigator at this point. It wasn't about whether Mr. Kritschek wished to talk to them now. He had requested counsel. And then Investigator Kritschek threw in about why we're here and any other information that we can share with you. This is exactly what the police in Munson and Hansen did. They said, because you're saying lawyer, we can't share information with you. Both Munson and Hannon recognized that this was an improper inducement, essentially a continued interrogation after a clear request for counsel. At this point, I would say I still fail to see how my client's statement, which mirrors the statement made in Hannon, also at the outset of the interrogation, was equivocal.
Could you remind me of the precise wording in Hannon? Or thereabouts?
Yes, Your Honor. One moment.
So I think this is really tricky. I mean, you've got one line, you know, in these different cases, and it's like, is it equivocal or not? So it seems like we really need to focus on a comparison of the language.
In Hannon, the suspect, I wrote in my brief, he was initially interrogated at length after he was Mirandized, and he actually agreed to waive. But once the police directly accused him of the murder, Hannon stated, then lock me up, and then I think we really should have an attorney. So the language is identical. If anything, in my case, the fact that my client said it immediately makes it an even more pressing issue.
Okay, so we've got Hannon. I think we really should have an attorney.
Yes, Your Honor.
In this case, I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer.
Yes.
And you're saying that it seems like the same expression. Why a different result in this case?
Yeah, if anything, in my client's statement, he was explaining why he wanted an attorney. He was saying it would be really smart, which is true. The fact that the suspect in Hannon did not identify he was making a smart call doesn't take away from the fact that they both made the same statement. I really think I should have an attorney.
Does the case law indicate that the statement, equivocal or not, occurring during the Miranda warning has any impact on the analysis?
Well, again, my client's statement came immediately after the full Miranda advisory.
Okay, so it's after the Miranda advisory, but before they say, will you waive your rights and agree to talk to us?
I believe so, except, you know.
You're right. So I read you your rights, you understood those rights, yeah. And do you wish to talk to us now? And what you're saying is, at that point, you don't get to ask, do you wish to talk to us, because he's made a statement that's equivalent of what was said in Hannon.
Well,
so no questioning should have occurred.
Neither this court or the Supreme Court of Minnesota have ever held that police are actually required to ask, do you understand these rights and are you willing to waive? I mean, the case law in this state is replete with examples of implied waiver, which never even broached the subject. The client just, or the suspect decided to keep talking, and that was implied waiver. The key is first informing of the Miranda rights. And I would concede here that Investigator Krichcek met that requirement, just that there was an immediate request for counsel. I've seen plenty of cases where, you know, such a statement was made and the police immediately left. There's other cases where then they came back later. I actually have one in this, a case I had in 2007, State v. Courtney Clark. It was kind of the same thing. My client invoked his rights, but then he called them back and wanted to talk later. None of that happened here. In fact, what follows is, apart from Investigator Krichcek's avoiding the topic of counsel, was saying, we can't share information with you, or do you want to hear what we have to say? Munson and Hannon both held that those were improper inducements, because...
But counsel, I want to go back to the language in Hannon, because Hannon also stated, it seems like pretty much immediately thereafter, I don't want to talk anymore, please. So wasn't there more to his statement in that case?
Well, that would just be an invocation of his other Miranda right. He asserted both the right to silence and counsel. And neither Munson nor Hannon nor Ray, any of the cases that I'm relying on, have, you know, any of those involved clear requests for counsel. There's never been a decision that I'm aware of where it says that additionally saying I don't want to speak to you is necessary. The case law about invoking the right to counsel, I think, has been very clear. In fact, you know, that's really what the original Miranda decision was about. you know, protecting the right to counsel, and that's why all of the jurisprudence that has flowed from Miranda makes a request for counsel something that is non-negotiable. I'm sure everyone in this room knows that if a suspect invokes his right to silence, the police can just come back. But when it comes to the right to counsel, it has to stop. The alternative, again, is if under the law the request was equivocal or ambiguous. The record just doesn't support that here, but even if it did, that's not what Investigator Krychek did. And I stand on that premise based on Edwards and Robinson. Now, at some point, I do feel I should address, I mean, if the court is okay with me moving on, what happens if my client's April 3rd, 2020 confession is taken out of the picture? I understand the standard of review here. Was that error harmless? It's not automatic that the conviction must fail. But I think in this case, I would first point out, you know, what additional evidence the state did not have that I think defense counsel at trial assiduously pointed out. There were no witnesses. There were no other witness statements about who was there, who may have done it. What the state did have was circumstantial evidence, which on appellate review must invite the question, could that reasonably mean something else? I will get straight to the forensic evidence focused on most closely by the state at trial, the frosting fingerprint on the doorknob that seems reasonable to assume was related to the open tin of bars that was left on the kitchen table. The kitchen table was at the opposite end of the building. But as I argue in my brief, the state's other witnesses and the fire marshal, Marshal Bexel, I think her name was, established that other people were in the building that day. Marshal Bexel testified that there was a cleaning person in the building on the day of the fire or the day before. I've also focused on the fact that the forensic evidence relating to the phone is essentially that there was a four-day gap around the September 22nd fire at the refuge. No one can dispute that the phone was off or not receiving, but I thought defense counsel asked appropriate questions by pointing out, and the investigator, Krull, I think his name was, Kroll, agreed that a phone can also not receive data when it is not getting Wi-Fi service, when it is turned off, if it is broken, or if it is lost. No one can say whether any of those happened or that it was turned off in order to facilitate this offense. The question is whether those are reasonable explanations. The state's other witnesses, including especially Ms. Pettick and Mr. Boshi, both established that my client essentially lived at the refuge. It was essentially a second home. So the question of his frequent access was established by the state. He was given a key. He could have been in there any time the day of or the day before for other than this purpose. I know we're dealing with a case where a confession was extracted, but I'm simply here respectfully applying what I urge to be the appropriate analysis. Take the confession out of the picture. Can the remaining evidence allow for a reasonable alternative? Can they all add up to some other explanation other than involvement in this offense? In order for a conviction to survive, if a confession is removed, the weight of the evidence, again, as held in Ray and Townsend, must support a conviction under circumstantial evidence of review, that the only reasonable hypothesis is guilt when there's no other evidence of witnesses, identifying statements, or physical evidence related to the fire. And if there are no more questions,
Thank you.
May it please the court. Counsel, good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. I think the case that is really controlling here, and I rely on it a lot in my brief, is the Supreme Court decision in 2011, State versus Ortega. The issue in Ortega is whether when the defendant was questioned, he asked, am I supposed to have a lawyer present? The Supreme Court went on to analyze the case law, and it cited Hannon. It cited to Munson. It cites to all the cases that appellant relies on. And it nonetheless found that this, am I supposed to have a lawyer present, was ambiguous. And it notes the language in Hannon. It doesn't just quote the language that appellant wants you to look at. It includes the language, then just take me to jail. Obviously, he's not going to be questioned when he's going to jail, right, in Hannon? He's going to be, oh, I'm sorry, can I have a drink of water and then lock me up? I think we should have an attorney. Lock me up, take me to jail. That he's ending the questioning without his attorney present.
Okay, so he said, I really, Hannon.
Yes,
Hannon. I think we really should have an attorney.
Then lock me up. I think we should have an attorney. So he's ending it. Take me away.
All right, but it looks like Mr. Bogatz, you know, he tried to say more. He says, I'm kind of, and the officer says, well, let me just finish this part first, and then goes back to the reading of the rights.
Yes. So
how is the statement, I think we really should have an attorney, different than I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer?
I think the lock me up phrase that prefaces it just
okay, so it was lock me up, I really think it would be smart.
Yep.
I really should have an attorney.
When in Ortega, when the Supreme Court is distinguishing Hannon, that's the phrase that it quotes. It doesn't just quote, okay, I think we should have an attorney. It quotes, can I have a drink of water and then lock me up? I think we should have an attorney.
What is the duty of the police to make further inquiry about and clarify whether the person wants an attorney or not? It seems like here they kind of equivocated in asking him that.
Well, Ortega says, and I'm quoting from, I quote this in my brief, but this is on page 72. Consequently, we hold that when a suspect makes an equivocal invocation of the right to counsel, providing the suspect with an accurate Miranda warning is sufficient as a matter of law to satisfy the stop and clarify rule. So he asks him multiple times, do you understand your Miranda rights? And the defendant says, yes, he does.
So the case you just quoted says providing the Miranda advisory is okay. In this case, the Miranda advisory had already been provided, after which appellant said, I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer. And
yes,
then there were questions about, will you waive your rights and talk to us?
Yes, and do you understand those rights? Yes, I do. Are you willing to waive those rights and speak with me today? The district court in its order lays out the...
So the state's position is, appellant's statement, I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer, was equivocal, so it was okay for the police to ask him questions to determine whether or not he wanted to speak with them.
Exactly, yes.
I mean, I guess I see a distinction between Ortega, am I supposed to have a lawyer present, sort of general question, and I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer. The statement here seems less equivocal than the one in Ortega.
Well, as Ortega talks about, you've got in Minnesota, you have the right against self-incrimination. In the Miranda that was read, the police officer told the defendant, you have the right to an attorney, and if you can't afford one, one will be appointed to represent you. And then you also have the right to have an attorney present during questioning. So I get that there's this, we want to clear up counsel, but really we need to clear up which part of counsel. And I think the officer does that by referring back, do you understand these rights? They had just been read to him. And as the district court notes, we look at the totality of the circumstances, what a reasonable officer. This officer knows that appellant is on probation. This isn't his first time through the criminal justice system. So what would a reasonable officer in this situation think? You can sense a little bit of impatience by the police officer. You know, when he asks that, he said, so let me just finish this part first, okay? I think he's a little irritated he's been cut off. But then he goes on to talk about, and do you wish to talk to us now about why we're here and any other information that we may be able to share you?
Even if the statement were equivocal, isn't the rule that the police can only ask questions to clarify desire to exercise the right to counsel? And if that's the law, it's not what happened here. The police didn't say, okay, now that you understand your rights, do you want to have an attorney present? They said, do you want to talk? So isn't that significant?
Well, okay, so you're waiving your rights at this point to talk to us. That's on my brief on page 10.
But it doesn't say you're waiving your right to an attorney.
Or to have an attorney present while you talk to us.
Well, it's referencing the Miranda rights that were just read to him, which included both of those that you have that.
What's the purpose of giving the Miranda rights, though?
To advise the defendant of the rights that they have. He then makes an ambiguous request. The officer says, do you understand the rights that I just read you? And he asks that question multiple times, including, so you're waiving your rights at this point to talk to us. So he's just been told you have the right to have an attorney present during questioning. Mm. And he says, so you're waiving your right to talk to us at this point. I think the district court reasonably concluded that that was adequate, given the follow-up question.
But I guess what I'm narrowing in on, it's like assuming its appellant statement was equivocal regarding whether or not he wanted to have a lawyer. Even if it's equivocal, the only thing the police are allowed to do is ask narrow questions designed to determine whether or not he wants to have a lawyer. And what you're saying is, well, a question about whether or not he's willing to talk is the equivalent to a narrow question regarding whether or not he wants counsel.
Well, do you you understood those rights?
How
yes.
Is that narrowly designed to clarify the suspect's true desires respecting counsel? I mean, that seems like a pretty broad question if what the case law requires is narrowly drawn questions specific to the right to counsel. Does the case law not require that?
Well, Ortega says you have to provide a Miranda. Miranda was provided. While Miranda is being read, he makes this statement. The police officer says, let me finish, and then ask, do you understand your rights? Yes. Having those rights, do you wish to speak with us? Yes. So
it was a little more than that, wasn't it?
I'm paraphrasing. There's several pages here.
Learn about the information we have.
Certainly.
That seems to go beyond, you know, trying to narrowly clarify whether he wants to have an attorney present. On that issue, is our review de novo?
Yes. I think Scales has probably changed a lot of the standard of review for this. You have the recordings now. Mm-hmm. The district court listens to the recording and makes one determination. Yeah, you're going to
really don't have factual findings.
I don't know that there's factual findings that really. The Now, the Supreme Court's made clear that the reasonable officer standard, which is the objective standard that this court applies, would a reasonable officer in this officer's position understand that to be an equivocal statement? That's de novo review. And that's really the issue, is would an objective officer understand that this was ambiguous? If yes,
let's go back to that. I'm wondering if you can speak about the State versus Hale case. The language used there was, I know I'm in some trouble, like I'm just going to need me a good lawyer, you know. And I think that in that case, the Supreme Court found that the defendant did not unequivocally invoke his right. So we're talking about clarification questions, but I'm still back on the first part where I'm trying to discern whether this, in fact, was an invocation of his right to counsel.
In Hale, the defendant says, quote, you know, like, I know I'm in some trouble, like, I'm just going to need me a good lawyer, you know? And the Supreme Court held this was equivocal and, quote, a fleeting offhand comment in mid-sentence about his future need for a good attorney and defending himself against the charges which were sure to follow.
Is the state's position that the statement, I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer, is not an unequivocal request for counsel, it's an equivocal statement? Or is the state's position that that statement didn't even rise to the level of an equivocal request for counsel?
It's an equivocal request to have counsel present at that time during questioning. As the district court notes, so there's an overlay of...
So then the state needs to get past the next hurdle, which is showing that any follow-up questions were narrowly tailored to determine whether or not he wanted to exercise his right to have an attorney present.
Yes, and having just gone through those rights, referring back to them, asking, do you understand them? The response is, yes, I do.
As Judge Smith points out, the question was, and do you wish to talk to us now about why we're here and any other information that we may be able to share with you? So, I mean, even if we were to give you, all right, well, he's referring back to the Miranda warnings with reference the right to counsel, the officer goes one step further and says, and any other information that we may be able to share with you. How does that second part of the sentence relate to the right to counsel or clarifying desire for counsel?
I'm sorry, could you just repeat that last part again?
Absolutely. So as I understand it, we've got, according to the state, an equivocal statement. I really think it would be smart for me to have a lawyer.
Yep.
And the state agrees that under the law, all the police can do at that point is ask narrowly drawn questions to confirm whether or not the suspect wants an attorney. And your argument is, the police did that by saying, well, I just read you your rights. You understood those rights. Do you wish to talk to me? So, in effect, the police were just asking about whether or not he wanted counsel, even though they didn't reference counsel. My concern is the police also said in that sentence, and do you wish to talk with us now about why we're here and any other information that we may be able to share with you? That second part of the sentence seems to go far afield from narrowly drawn questions to clarify the desire for counsel.
I'm not going to argue that it doesn't go afield. The question is, did the officer sufficiently clarify the defendant's wishes here? And the district court found that they did and examined it, and under the circumstances.
But I guess that's where there's a disconnect, because you're saying, well, the standard is, did the police sufficiently clarify the request for counsel? And I was of the impression that what we need to be looking at are the questions the police asked to make sure the police didn't go beyond what was permissible in terms of clarification.
Well, I'm relying on Ortega. That's what I rely on in my brief. That's what I'm relying on. Providing the suspect with an accurate Miranda warning is sufficient as a matter of law. They're in the midst of it. They're discussing the Miranda rights as they're having this discussion.
So Ortega says providing the Miranda warning
is sufficient.
Is sufficient in and of itself to clarify the request for counsel.
Yes.
Okay, so then from that as applied here. You're saying the police saying, well, you've just been given your rights. Do you want to give them up? That's what Ortega says is allowed and is sufficient.
I see my time is up. Can I
please do
go over to answer your question? Yes, I believe that. These are all very fact-specific cases. So on the facts of this, had it played out differently, I probably wouldn't be making these arguments. But this is in the middle of the Miranda warning. The officer keeps referencing back to it. I think it's hard to distinguish Ortega. Well, we haven't had any questions about the harmless error, but I just ask the court to affirm. I know my harmless error argument is maybe unusual, but on the facts of this case, I think it's an argument that
thank you.
Is persuasive. Thank you.
Mr. Marvili, rebuttal argument? And if it doesn't take you too far afield from what you had intended to argue, could you address the question I have, which is, should we be looking at what the police said and whether their statements were or were not permissible in light of what is allowed when presented with an equivocal request for counsel?
If nothing else, Your Honor, because that's the way it was laid out in the district court order, then, of course, I agree you must look at it. But if I may, you know, I would still argue that we don't get to that point here by distinguishing Ortega in a way I think the panel already has, but I'll just make it clear. And counsel even pointed out that, you know, Ortega cited to Munson and Hansen because those were examples of unequivocal requests. In Ortega, he asked the police officer, am I supposed to have an attorney? I mean, I would agree that that's equivocal. That doesn't indicate that he's made up his mind yet, unlike my client, who's essentially the same as Hannon. And I would disagree with counsel's assessment of what the actual holding of Ortega was, that just the Miranda advisory alone is enough, because as this court has already pointed out, that in Robinson, it was follow-up questions about true desires respecting counsel, I believe is the quote. And the fact is, the police officer in Ortega did exactly that on page 73. His next statement was, I can't talk to you if you want to speak to a lawyer. While I don't consider that to be an optimal clarifying act, at least he put it to the guy, do you want a lawyer? I mean, that's the difference here. Investigator Kritschek avoided this subject. So, and I have distinguished Hale, which looking at the statement in isolation could seem problematic for me, but the difference with Hale was that statement about get me a lawyer came in the middle of a second interrogation. He had already provided a full statement after a first Mirandized statement. Then he was well into a second Mirandized statement when he invoked that right. That's why the Hale court said that this was just a statement made in passing. But I do not believe there is any case in Minnesota where an immediate request for counsel, and going by Munson, which is from 94, and then Hannon, which was nearly 10 years later, would find that to be equivocal, or at least something the police must not directly address. I would reiterate that the Miranda right to counsel has never been conditioned on a suspect also articulating that I don't want to speak to you anymore. The Robinson court indicated that a suspect's request for counsel is a prophylactic measure. They don't apply that really to the assertion of the right to silence. It's the right to counsel that gets these ironclad protections because the suspects are at such a disadvantage. The last thing I would do here with my time remaining, unless there's other questions, is I felt in my harmless error analysis that one of the points I relied on, I had stated in my brief that the other state's witnesses pointed out there were other disgruntled employees. I was somewhat surprised to see I didn't make any specific cites to the record They are in there. I stand by, but I would just briefly reiterate here that Ms. Petrick herself was disgruntled, but the key, and she testified that the director of Compassion House quit because he wasn't getting paid. And the witness Jopp is the one who actually testified that none of the employees were getting paid because there was no money. So basically, the state's witnesses established that everybody at that place had a reason to have a grievance with the Mannings. And then what followed, giving his son a contract for $9,000. I'll just say that that should apply to the weight considerations and rest on the rest of the points I've made here, unless there are any further questions. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you to both of you for your briefing and your arguments this morning. The matter is submitted. You'll have a decision within 90 days.